This morning, at least five people are dead and dozens more injured after an SUV plowed through a holiday parade route in Wisconsin. We'll go live to one hospital where victims were transported, and NBC's Tom Winter has the latest on what police think was the motive here. We are also following this weekend's chaos from inside Atlanta's International Airport after a gun accidentally discharged and the passenger managed to get away after his firearm went off.
Not sure how that happened.
Plus, as more sentences handed down for people who took part in the January 6th insurrection, the attack of the Capitol, one judge is still placing the blame right at the feet of Donald Trump. That is, one former Trump advisor has a plan to keep him from running again for president. Remind Trump he could be the biggest loser. A reminder to Trump that he could be the biggest loser in American politics. The next, Adlai Stevenson. And as many experts predicted, Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty of all charges on Friday. Still, one of his attorneys is striking out at extreme Republican members of Congress and Donald Trump Jr. will tell you why. Good morning. It's a busy morning. Welcome to Morning Joe, Monday, November 22nd. We'll begin in Wisconsin, where at least five people are dead and more than 40 are injured after an SUV drove through a Christmas parade in Waukesha. Yesterday afternoon, a red SUV crashed through barricades set up for the parade, hitting dozens of people in attendance. The moment of impact was caught on camera. Four senior law enforcement officials tell NBC News police are questioning a person of interest who may have a long criminal history. Those sources say the person of interest may have been fleeing from an earlier incident involving a knife when the vehicle reached the parade. We'll speak with Tom Winter in a moment on the investigation. Waukesha Public Schools are closed today, and the city is providing counseling services. The police will hold another press conference this afternoon at 1 o'clock local time. And, of course, we'll be carrying that on MSNBC here and covering every angle of this story as it is still developing. Joining us now from a children's hospital in Milwaukee, where several of the victims were transported, NBC News correspondent Megan Fitzgerald. Megan, what can you tell us?
Mika, good morning. What we know right now is that this hospital behind me, Children's Hospital here in Milwaukee, has confirmed at least 15 patients admitted here. We know more than 40 people are injured. And at this point, five people have lost their lives. We know that that number could possibly increase as several people are in critical condition at this hour. But, you know, the fact that we're standing in front of a children's hospital really gets to the heart of this tragedy. We're talking about children, families excited to go to this annual Christmas parade in the center of town, something that was canceled last year because of the pandemic, until this red SUV came plowing down this street, taking out everyone in its path. I want you to listen to what one eyewitness told us. Take a listen.
My daughter, right, she was standing right in front of me, but she was maybe 5 feet away from, must have been going, I mean, at least 40 to 50 miles an hour, just came through. And I saw people on the ground, there's blood. It was really bad.
Yeah, so this woman, obviously, among many others who made it out, but you got to imagine the trauma that is now setting in these children, these parents watching this tragedy unfold. The archdiocese here in this community tells us that among the victims is a Catholic priest, along with parishioners and several Catholic school children. This is an ongoing investigation. There are still answers that we are waiting for, and we know that we are likely going to get some more information on this in the coming hours, when police hold that next update and press conference. Mika.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank
NBC's
you, Megan.
Megan Fitzgerald. Greatly appreciated. What a tragedy. It's unfathomable. Let's bring in right now NBC News investigations reporter Tom Winter to figure out how this nightmare unfolded. Tom, a couple of things right now based on your sources. They do not believe this is an act of terrorism.
That's correct, Joe. And good morning. In speaking with at least four to five senior law enforcement officials have been briefed on this. It's the reporting of myself, my colleague Jonathan Deans, and Mike Cosner, that at this stage of the investigation, at this moment, at least what they've uncovered so far, there's no indication or nexus to terrorism here, either foreign-inspired, think something along the lines of an ISIS-inspired attack, nothing domestic, something that might have to do with a racial or ethnic motive. So there's no indication of that so far in this investigation. There's also no indication so far that this has anything to do with a retaliation or retaliatory attack tied to the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict either. So I think those are two important things to say right away. We're also being told that essentially this is the chain of events is that as police best understand it at this time. So there was some sort of a knife fight or stabbing that occurred in a nearby park in this town, in this city yesterday. And then this person of interest who's being questioned at this time or was at least being questioned into the late hours last night is somebody who was involved in that. And in the course of fleeing that, drove into this parade and obviously killed and injured a number of adults and children. Now, I think a couple of things that we're still trying to get a handle on is why did this person choose this particular route to flee this crime? Obviously, as we just saw from that map, there's more than one street. So we need to try to get a better sense of why they chose this particular path based on our reporting, based on public source information that we've been able to look into. This person has a deep and detailed criminal history, a history of violence. So that's something that we'll be taking a closer look at. Same with law enforcement today. So we'll be following that. I think a couple of other things that we'll be keeping an eye on is, you know, was this person being chased at all? If not, then again, why did they choose this route? So you can understand why we're being so cautious at this stage, Joe and Mika, as far as why we're saying, look, it's still early in the investigation, but based on that, we're getting some indications that this is not terrorism related.
Well, again, the information mm-hmm. that you've been getting in your reporting and others have been getting through the night, again, and that's just where we are right now at 6:07 a.m. on the East Coast on Monday morning, is that this was a person with a long criminal history fleeing a knife fight in a nearby park. And again, based on your reporting, it just seems like he was finding a route to escape that knife fight, that it was actually more of a random choice.
That's what all indications are at this point. I'd like to know why he chose this particular route. Also, there was some indication in recent court filings that he may have been in trouble with the law in the past several weeks. So was this somebody who just decided, I'm not going back to jail and I want to do a lot of harm and saw a target of opportunity in this Christmas parade? Either way, it's just a shocking and horrific crime. Having seen the video that you played there till its conclusion is apparent, it's just very difficult to look at, Joe.
NBC's Tom Winter, thank you very much for your reporting this morning. Now to this new polling. Has President Biden's approval rating at 44%? That is from the latest CBS News YouGov poll, which is slightly higher than some other recent surveys, though still a 6-point drop from when the same poll was conducted last month. On his handling of the issues, the president is in positive territory for only one area, his distribution of the COVID-19 vaccine. But now the president has his Build Back Better Act, the sweeping social spending package to run on, which passed in the House on Friday.
On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 213. The Build Back Better bill is passed.
The Senate is hoping to vote on the bill before Christmas. Every Democratic senator will need to support the package for it to pass there. Let's bring in the host of Way Too Early and White House bureau chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire, professor at Princeton University, Eddie Claude Jr., and MSNBC contributor and best-selling author of the Confidence Code series, Caddy K. Good to have you all with us this morning.
So why don't we just start with the last person we saw in that shot, Caddy K. Nancy Pelosi, who now has was the guiding force in pushing through the Affordable Care Act, the guiding force in pushing through COVID relief earlier this year, the transportation bill, and now Build Back Better.
Wow.
Certainly, you look at her resume of what she's been able to shepherd through the House, and I heard from one cynic after another, this was never going to happen. But let's just start with Nancy Pelosi. She obviously ranks up there legislatively as one of the most successful speakers of all time, doesn't she?
Yeah, I remember after the Affordable Care Act passed thinking that Barack Obama owed Nancy Pelosi flowers for the rest of her life. And I think Joe Biden probably joins that flower gifting session now by Pelosi's ability to get the votes. This was a really tough passage. I mean, we saw all of the division within House Democrats, those who didn't want to vote on this until the Build Back Better was actually linked and didn't want to vote on the early infrastructure, the hard infrastructure bill until this bill was going to pass as well. There was a lot of dissent amongst progressives in her caucus. She had to deal with moderates in her caucus at various stages. It was not a pretty process, but she got it. And she got both the hard infrastructure bill voted on and she got the soft infrastructure bill voted on. And we've always said no one can count votes like Nancy Pelosi. And even when it was looking rough for her, Democrats in the White House and on Capitol Hill were reminding us when she gets these votes through, people won't remember what it looked like getting these votes through. They'll just remember that they passed. Now, of course, it has to get out to the people. This money has to get out to Americans and it has to be felt around the country. And that's going to take a little bit longer.
Yeah. So, Jonathan Lemire, we talk about Nancy Pelosi. Let's talk about what happened on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, where you had Joe Biden, who came in telling everybody, I can get things done. And you look at his numbers that have been dropping, because he hasn't gotten a lot of legislation done. There have just been a lot of Democrats in the halls of Congress yelling at each other and talking to reporters. Now a massive infrastructure package drops, passes. Now this massive Build Back Better bill passes. And at the end of the day, the only reason it passed along with Nancy Pelosi was because at some point progressives just put up their hands and said, listen, we don't trust the moderates in the Senate, but we trust Joe Biden. And Joe Biden says he's going to get this done, which is why it got done.
Yeah, the White House believes after a real summer slump that extended into the fall that it has turned the corner. And you're right. President Biden, then candidate Biden, campaigned on this promise that the government could work again, that he could restore Americans' faith in the federal government, in the bureaucracy, in the White House after four tumultuous years of Donald Trump. And he wanted to aim high, prove that democracies could still work and could compete across the globe with autocracies like China. And certainly this summer, hit on the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Delta variant sent COVID cases surging, which cost his poll numbers in terms of his handling of the pandemic. And then the messy infighting on Capitol Hill. We certainly saw the public was ran out of patience and said, well, wait, where are things getting done? But White House aides that I've talked to over the last few days believe that this is a turning point for the administration, that Friday was a huge deal to get this done through the House. And they acknowledge there's still a ways to go in the Senate. And progressives, who, by the way, have sacrificed a lot more here than the conservative, more moderate senators in terms of this negotiation, they did put their faith in Joe Biden, in part because he has a relationship with Senator Manchin. He has extracted a framework promise to get this done. Look, it's still going to be a tortured exist process here. Their thing is going to fall in and out. It's going to go to the Senate. This bill is going to go back to the House. We're not at the finish line just yet. It may extend into early next year. We'll see about that Christmas deadline. But the White House believes they have some momentum. They believe that those poll numbers will go up again with just two storm clouds on the horizon. Obviously, the ongoing matter of inflation and that we are seeing COVID cases start to tick up again among the unvaccinated. But that as we head into the holiday travel season, that's something they're nervously watching, too, even though the nation is awash in available vaccines.
Well, you look at the numbers on that CBS poll issue by issue, and they're just some numbers that are sitting where they are right now because of the realities of inflation. We have inflation, which, of course, could be predicted. A lot of people were warning about inflation coming out of COVID. People have $2.3 trillion in their savings. They're going to start spending it, especially when they get the opportunity to start spending it on services. So on inflation, his numbers are at 33%. They'll stay there until inflation washes out over the next 6 to 9 months, which it should do. The same thing with the economy. Eddie Glaude, you look at that 39%. It's pretty obvious. That economy number and also sort of a feeling about how America's doing, that's just going to go up and down, Eddie, with COVID cases. Is Eddie still there or do we just have the poll?
He's there.
There's Eddie. Okay, I just didn't see you. I kept saying your name, which was a cue that I'd love to see Eddie right now. I'm going to talk about your trip abroad in a little bit. But Eddie, when COVID cases went down this summer, Joe Biden's numbers were high. When Delta variant came up, his numbers dipped. I suspect that when those COVID cases wash out, those numbers will go back up again.
You know, Joe, I completely agree. I mean, as we see some kind of stability, as we emerge, at least hopefully emerge from the disrupting effects of COVID, I think those numbers will change. But there are some disturbing features of that poll. I mean, one of the things that I'm really concerned about is numbers with regards to African Americans, right? We see that those numbers are on the decline. It has everything to do with the fact that he hasn't brought serious voting rights to the tape. So there's a lot here that we have to kind of think about, but I think you're absolutely right, Joe. If we see some kind of stability with regards to COVID, we might see those numbers increase.
Well, and another thing, Eddie, you see the numbers down among Black Americans, you see them down among Hispanic Americans, you see them down among Democrats. He's at 80% instead of 88, 89, 90% where he normally would be. I suspect some of those numbers are going to tick back up when Build Back Better becomes law. But again, those are numbers that will go back to Biden or a Democrat as elections come up. But there's no doubt you underlined something very important. He needed to get this legislation done in his mind in his first year in office. But as we turn the corner and go into 2022, I can't imagine anything more important than getting the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill passed.
You know, Joe, I completely agree. And part of what I think African-American voters are looking for, the fight. We just heard Kyrsten Sinema through her recent reporting that she's been talking with the reporters a lot lately, talking about her faith in the filibuster. That doesn't bode well for voting rights legislation. And so we need to see the Democratic Party fighting with regards to this issue. We saw some of that indication of what might happen if we don't get some fight in this regard in Virginia. And we worry about that moving into 2020, 2021, 2022. Obviously, I am still sleepy because of Paris, Joe. You can tell. I just got out of yesterday. It is amazing.
Well, don't worry about it, Eddie. We know you're a little tired. We're just
we're
here
glad
because you're beautiful.
You're just
such a good-looking guy.
Yeah.
That's why you're like wallpaper for us
exactly.
Right now until you can start talking again. Yeah, exactly.
All right, so President Biden and members of his inner circle have reportedly told allies in recent days he plans to run for re-election in 2024. According to the Washington Post, the message is aimed in part at tamping down the assumption among many Democrats that Biden may not seek re-election given his age and waning popularity, while also effectively freezing the field for Vice President Harris and other potential presidential hopefuls.
Jonathan Lemire, of course, as you know, Meek and I spent a good bit of time in Washington last week. I can't believe it. Here we are. We're not even through his first year. And it's what you're hearing people talking about in restaurants. Is he going to run again? He says he's going to run again. His people are saying, but is he going to run again? I think it's a little early to be worried about that, but Washington seems transfixed with this question.
He's running again,
is the question. I mean, I think they can start worrying about this a year, year and a half from now.
Yeah, Joe, I saw it in Washington last week, and you're right. This is what people are talking about. There's always beltway chatter, anxiety about the incumbent president. But I think this deserves a little more examination, simply because, not just because of the president's age, but also because of while he was running last time in the 2020 campaign, there was sort of this unspoken suggestion by some or whispered suggestion by some of his advisors that this may be a one-term president, that there was the idea that he would be sort of a restore the office, the dignity of the office, and then be a more of a transition transition figure to the next generation of Democrats. And that, to be clear, the president's inner circle never said that. Joe Biden himself has never said that. And President Biden has said privately and publicly he is going to run again. He has every intention to run again. And we should take him at his word. We should believe that he will. Now, obviously, the caveat here is even if he were to not run again, you would never admit that. Of course, you have to look like you're running again, because the minute you aren't, you become a lame duck and your political capital vanishes. But that does not seem to be the case here. 2024 is a long way off. This speculation and discussion seems premature. The president has said, both publicly and to his closest confidants, he intends to run again. And yes, there's chatter about the vice president. There's chatter about other Democrats who might step in. But for now, we should take him at his word that he will be a candidate again for re-election.
We got to keep in mind where the chatter comes from, especially with former President Trump and his cronies probably fueling a lot of that. I mean, I've spoken to people who spend much of the day with the president every day. They say he's incredibly inspiring. And again, never underestimate Joe Biden. People make the mistake. They always do. As for former President Donald Trump, if he plans to run again in 2024, an ex-advisor reportedly has a strategy to convince him not to. The Atlantic's Peter Nicholas reports, quote, anticipating that Trump may not know who Adlai Stevenson was or that he lost two straight presidential elections in the 1950s, this ex-advisor figures he or someone else might need to explain the man's unhappy fate. They'll remind Trump that if he were beaten in 2024, he would join Stevenson as one of history's serial losers. I think that would resonate, said this person who, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity to talk more freely. Trump hates losers. Stevenson, the former governor of Illinois, was defeated by former President Dwight Eisenhower in both the 1952 and the 1956 general elections. He would also go on to lose the Democratic primary to JFK in 1960.
Kathy Kay, I've talked to people close to Donald Trump for several years now, leading up to 2020, and still talking to them, as people talk about 2024. Of course, the hot take is, of course, Donald Trump's going to run. He can't stay away from the attention. He loves the attention. Those closer to him say the only thing that is more driving for him than winning an election is his fear of losing an election. Yeah. He can't stand the idea of being a two-time loser. Question is, will that stop him? Even if he doesn't know who Adlai Stevenson is, will that stop him from running in 24?
Look, he may not know his history from the 1950s, but he probably knows his history with his own father. And there was clearly something in that relationship, Joe, where Donald Trump's father seems to sit there on his shoulder in his head saying, you're a loser. You're going to be a loser. Being a loser is the worst possible thing. There was that story that came out in a biography of Trump's during the last election campaign about how Donald Trump goes to the hospital when his son, Don Jr., is born. Mm. And Ivana Trump is saying to him, let's call him Don Jr. And what's Trump's reaction? What happens if he's a loser? It is the worst possible thing that Donald Trump can ever call somebody else, and it's the worst possible thing that he could think that he is. And yeah, he might like the rallies, and he might like the power and the idea that he is still the person that can control the Republican Party and that he can be back in the White House. And I'm sure he would love the triumph of winning. But stack that up against even the smallest possibility of losing, and I agree with you, the possibility of losing trumps the possibility of winning.
Well, and you look at what happened in 2020. I mean, you just look at the arc from 2016 to 2020. You project that forward, and as one potential Republican candidate for president in 2024 told me last week, nobody wants him to campaign for them in any swing states. If you're running statewide in Pennsylvania, you don't want him there in a general election. Same with Michigan. Same with Wisconsin, same with any swing state. And that tells you all you need to know about what's happened to his popularity, even over the last year since the election and also since January the 6th.
And still ahead on Morning Joe, what is next for Kyle Rittenhouse? The jury has delivered its not guilty verdict, but the legal fallout could be far from over. Plus the latest on the search for the passenger whose gun accidentally discharged inside Atlanta's International Airport over the weekend. And protests erupt across parts of Europe as a new wave of coronavirus lockdowns go into effect. COVID cases are also on the rise across the U.S. We'll be joined by Dr. Anthony Fauci to talk about all of that as we head into the Thanksgiving holiday. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back. Past the hour, a live look at Washington, D.C. The sun has yet to come up, but the commute has begun. Warrants have been issued for the man who fled from Atlanta's International Airport on Saturday after his gun went off during a search of his luggage. Officials say it was an accidental discharge, but it caused a panic among holiday travelers as some believed a gunman was inside the terminal. According to the TSA, an officer was checking a passenger's bag after an X-ray machine identified a prohibited item. When the bag was opened, the passenger lunged and grabbed the firearm, which then discharged. Ugh. Police are still looking for the suspect, 42-year-old Kenny Wells. He ran out of the security line and exited the airport with the gun.
Let's bring in, live from Atlanta International Airport, NBC News correspondent Tom Costello. Tom, I can't even get shampoo through TSA checkpoint sometimes. How does a guy have a gun? And I'm not being facetious here. How does a guy have a gun? It's discharged. He grabs it and then makes it out of the airport without authorities stopping him.
Well, to be clear, he did not get through the checkpoint, right? The checkpoint did its job. It spotted something that he shouldn't have had. They pulled the bag aside for a secondary screening. He immediately lunged for the bag, apparently remembering he had a gun in there. And when he lunged forward and grabbed the gun, it went off. Thankfully, nobody was hit by the gunfire. He then grabbed the gun and ran out the exit. Now, keep in mind, he wasn't yet on the secure side of the airport. He was still on this side of the airport. And as you know, at TSA checkpoints, they have TSA officers there, but they don't have cops there normally, right? The police are within, I don't know, you know, a few minutes of response, but they're usually not standing right there. Anyway, this caused a massive, as you would imagine, a massive stampede on Saturday. It happened at 1:30 in the afternoon. Thousands of people scrambling, afraid that there was an active gunman. They actually issued a ground stop. All ground air traffic or ground plane traffic was grounded, as you would expect. As they searched for this suspect, they immediately identified him, though, because he'd given his ID, right? So they knew who they were looking for. And the cops knew immediately this is a wanted felon. 42-year-old Kenny Wells, he has a history with the Atlanta Police Department, and so now they are actively searching for him. But guys, the other important element to the story is that Atlanta leads the nation in gun confiscations at TSA checkpoints. Just this year, they've already confiscated 450. That's more than one a day that they confiscated at this airport. As you know, Georgia has some pretty loose gun laws right now, and the other states that have high gun confiscation rates at TSA checkpoints also have looser gun laws. And so to some extent, this is what happens when you have looser gun laws. But nonetheless, the police are looking for Kenny Wells right now in Atlanta. They say he is well known to them.
So Tom, you know, Meek and I have been traveling a good bit over the past 3 or 4 months. When we first started traveling again, there were a few empty seats here and there. But even before we got into holiday season, you get on most flights, man, they are packed. People are ready to get moving again, which I, of course, see as great news for the airlines, for the airports, for all of us. What does this holiday weekend look like? I would guess since so many people stayed at home last year, you're probably expecting a really busy one, aren't you?
We're absolutely seeing breakout traffic and travel, we should say. 2.2 million passengers every single day. So that's during the Thanksgiving period. So we are getting back very close to 2019 Thanksgiving travel levels. In all, about 53 million people will be traveling. Keep in mind, most people are traveling by road. But the reason we're watching the airports is because, as you know, over the last few months, we've had several airline meltdowns. We've had American and Southwest and Spirit stranding thousands upon thousands of customers, actually hundreds of thousands of customers. And so the pressure is on those airlines to, in fact, deliver on their promise that they say that they have streamlined operations, that they have staffed up, that they're ready for this. Listen, as you know, the big variable is weather. If they get thrown the weather curveball, that could really hamper their operations. Thankfully, with the exception of some wind and rain on the East Coast, things are looking pretty good for now. Of course, we then got to get into the Christmas holiday season. But keeping in mind how much pressure is on the airlines, American has offered their pilots financial incentives to work over the holidays. The pilots have said no. They've said the problem isn't with us. The problem is with management and, they say, antiquated scheduling software. That's why they've had so many issues. Southwest offered their people frequent flyer points if they work over the holidays. And they kind of got a mixed reaction from the Southwest employees. The pressure is on those airlines in particular, guys.
Wow. Yeah. Hey, Tom, one final question. Just circling back, you may have already reported on this, but never heard it. When Southwest had that meltdown that ended up costing them a ton of money, there were some who believed that it was because of the COVID vaccine requirements. They were denying that. The pilots union was denying that. Do you have a better grasp on what caused that? I think it was like a $75 million meltdown for the company. What caused that meltdown?
Yeah. Every single person I've talked to, from the line pilot to management to airline execs to airline analysts, they all say this was not about a COVID pilot protest. Zero chance of that, they say. The problem was that, first of all, Southwest does not operate a normal hub and spoke program. In other words, if they get behind in one airport, for example, Delta owns Atlanta, right? If they have a problem in Atlanta, they have lots of backup crews that can jump in and immediately take over the next flight. Southwest does not operate a typical hub and spoke program. They got behind because of weather in Florida. Then they had an ATC, an air traffic control issue, for a few hours. And then they had military flight ops over that particular Friday and Saturday. And as a result, they got behind. It snowballed. It took them days to catch up. I talked to airline analysts who said, listen, if this had been another typical airline that has the hub and spoke program, Southwest probably would have been okay. But everybody has denied this has anything to do with pilots protesting the vaccine. Guys, I will just tell you, you know, I've been on, I think, 30, I've been to 30 cities so far this year. I've flown a lot this year. I sat in front of an American Airlines pilot about 2 months ago. He was deadheading, right? So he was going to another location. And he was sitting behind me, didn't know who I was, griping and complaining loud enough that everybody on the plane could hear about having to be vaccinated and how this was absolutely against his rights and he shouldn't have to be vaccinated. Meanwhile, he's surrounded by paying passengers who are sitting there with masks on. Presumably, they want to know that they're safe. So there is a bit of a dichotomy there in terms of the airlines trying to spread the message that you're safe on board their planes. And some pilots still, specifically American Airlines pilots, there's real reluctance there to get vaccinated among some in the union. Not all, but among some in the union.
Yeah. All right. Tom Costello, thank you so much for your reporting this morning. Thanks for being on. So coming up, we know the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Coming up on Morning Joe, President Biden reacts, and also how the defense attorney reacted as well. What he said about how some members of Congress came out in support of Kyle Rittenhouse, some even offering him jobs. What the defense attorney thinks about that. That's next. 41 past the hour on Friday, a jury in Kenosha, Wisconsin found Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty on all counts. The teen was on trial for fatally shooting two people and injuring a third during protests in the city last year. In a White House statement, President Biden said in part, quote, while the verdict in Kenosha will leave many Americans feeling angry and concerned, myself included, we must acknowledge that the jury has spoken. Earlier in the day, the president had this to say.
Well, look, I stand by what the jury has concluded. The jury system works and we have to abide by it.
Jonathan Lemire, that's exactly what we want a president to say right there. What he said in the clip, I could have done without the dicta later on where he's talking about being angry and concerned and everything. I understand there's a political element, but when you're president of the United States, it's something Donald Trump would never do. But this is what we expect our presidents to do. He said, I don't know what the jury saw, which is where he's saying what we all should say, which is after the verdict comes in, we weren't there. We weren't there during OJ's verdict. We didn't hear everything that OJ's jury heard, right? So everybody have their opinion before, but after the jury speaks, that's our system. And the president said that. And then he went on to say, you know, we have to trust the jury system. We have to trust it. It reminds me of what Churchill said about democracy. Democracy is the worst form of government in the world, other than every other form of government that's ever been created. That's how I feel about the jury system. Maybe it doesn't always get it right, but it's the law, and it's the best system in the world. Our rule of law is the best system in the world. And I thought President Biden's spoken statements there, not what he said later on, but the spoken statements there was exactly what we want to hear from Republican or Democratic presidents. Mm-hmm.
Now, Joe, you just outlined it. The second statement, the one that was put out on Twitter and on White House press release, was certainly a nod to the politics of it, because his initial statement on the White House lawn definitely drew some blowback from members of his own party who were upset at the verdict. But what he said there at the beginning, I think you saw what his instinct was. And I talked to an aide afterwards who said, look, the president had said ahead of time that that was what he was going to say, one way or the other, no matter what the verdict was. And let's remember, earlier in the year, he got in some trouble during the Floyd case in Minnesota, where he suggested that when the jury went to deliberations, what he had hoped the verdict might be, and later privately and then publicly expressed regret that he did that, that he does believe that the jury system should be its own matter. It should be free of outside influence, particularly from prominent politicians, and none more prominent than the president of the United States. You're right. His predecessor would not have done that. He was happy to put his thumb on the scale anytime he could. There was no norm when it came to this. He wasn't happy to shatter. This president handled things differently. But the later statement was a nod to the politics of the moment as well.
Well, the thing is, let people get upset on Twitter. Let people say what they're going to say. President of the United States needs to say what Joe Biden said coming off the helicopter. And again, I'll say that 4 years, 8 years from now, whoever the president is, respect the jury deliberation and process. And by the way, in this case, and by the way, let's bring in right now former prosecutor Charles Coleman. Charles, I know you'll agree with me. In fact, when I first became a lawyer, I had my mentor said, Joe, here's the deal. Juries, they usually get it right. You know, 90% of the time, 10% or 80% of the time, he goes, 10% of the time, you're going to get a verdict that you just don't understand. And it's going to work against you. And you're going to think it's the worst verdict ever. And they're going to be another 10% of the time where you're going to win a case you just don't deserve to win. He goes, but for the most part, it washes itself out. In this case, if people don't like the verdict, Charles, I would guess you'd probably agree with me. They need to change the laws in Wisconsin so there's not open carry of AR-15s. They need to change the laws of Wisconsin. This sort of reckless behavior is penalized by law. But until they do that, I mean, jury, follow the jury instructions, right?
Well, Joe, on that point, I do have to agree with you. I do think that for a lot of people, particularly in the public who did not watch all of the elements of the trial and all of the different things that went on, they may not necessarily have understood what it was that was prompting the jury to make the decisions that they made. Right. They may not understand what the facts were that ultimately caused the jury to render the verdict that they did. And so that's why you may have some of the public outcry. And I do understand and I agree with you that on a certain level, you have to take your verdict as you get your verdict, the same way you have to take your jury as you find your jury. However, there is one friendly amendment that I have to offer to what you had to say around President Biden's comments. On a certain level, You have to understand that how we unpack the Rittenhouse verdict has greater implications for what we do going forward. When you talk about periods of racial unrest, particularly high periods of racial unrest in America, how we have the conversation about what happened to Kyle Rittenhouse and because of Kyle Rittenhouse has greater implications, because what happens now in a situation where there's a greater period of racial unrest and someone does not like protesters or why they are protesting and decides that they want to try to take advantage of the situation and use Kyle Rittenhouse as an example. Now, what I do know, of course, the law, as you talked about in Kenosha, was not necessarily the best. As we talked about sort of last week, there was an uphill battle that the prosecution was facing. The judge didn't do them any favors. All of these things coalesce into a situation that did not bode well for the prosecution. So that's the technical side. But when you talk about this right on a larger level, I think it's important to understand that from the moment that Kyle Rittenhouse pulled that trigger, he was either going to be a martyr or a hero. And I think understanding and dissecting that principle is really important in the larger conversation about what this really means.
Well, and Charles, again, I just want to underline a point, because there are people that were angry and upset about the verdict. I understand that. What I'm talking to is what the president of the United States should or shouldn't say. And I'm glad Joe Biden said what he said, but I certainly understand people being angry and upset. I guess what frustrates me is they can continue to get angry and upset, but unless they start focusing on winning local state house races, on change, because everything I hear people complaining about, like the Rittenhouse this weekend, I hear obviously a lot of complaining about the Rittenhouse verdict. I understand that, but it was the law. So change the law. If you're a Democrat, elect local Democrats to win races in Wisconsin. I heard people complaining about gerrymandering. Okay, well, that just doesn't happen. It's not like that doesn't descend down from the heavens. That happens because of the impact of elections. So I guess that's my point. And what frustrates me is that, and you said this last week, you were talking about the jury instructions. You were talking about what the actual law was for self-defense. I mean, the prosecutor had an uphill battle from day one because what the law was in Wisconsin.
No, you're correct. And I do think that the question now becomes, what is the plan going forward? When you see a verdict like this, when you have an outcome that does not work, what is the plan going forward? But in addition to what I talked about last week with respect to the law, I also talked about privilege. And there's a certain level of that plays a role into what we saw and how it played out with respect to Kyle Rittenhouse and this verdict. But from a strictly legal standpoint, you are correct. We do have to talk about, well, are these laws antiquated? Are we electing people who are going to write laws that are contemporary and speak to the needs of our time? And quite frankly, another conversation that was a big part of what ended up happening in Wisconsin was, are we putting judges on the bench that are going to abide by the rule of law and hold and not make things a kangaroo court?
Well, meanwhile, Kyle Rittenhouse's lawyer is slamming Republican members of Congress for saying they want to offer his client a job on Capitol Hill. At least two Republican congressmen said they would like to hire Rittenhouse as an intern. Defense lawyer Mark Richard accused the Republicans of trying to cash in on Rittenhouse, telling Insider on Saturday he thinks it's, quote, disgusting. Richards also rebuked Donald Trump Jr., who in a tweet that has since been deleted, encouraged people to support a gun rights organization that said it would award Rittenhouse an AR-15 for his defense of gun rights. Richards told Insider he's an idiot. I don't have to expand on that because it speaks for itself. The defense attorney also said he was against a film crew following the 18-year-old throughout the murder trial as part of an upcoming Fox Nation documentary.
I did not approve of that. I threw him out of the room several times. And I'm not suggesting that Fox or some other network. I don't think a film crew is appropriate for something like this.
So, Eddie Gloud, there were really, I can't even say unfortunate things that were said. I've got to say there were things said that sounded came from members of a fascist party, where people celebrating the Rittenhouse verdict, going online, members of Congress going online, celebrating that verdict and saying, now go out and be armed and dangerous. I want followers to be armed and dangerous. I want to be careful exactly the exact quotes, but that was the general play of it. We don't want to give any of these people any attention. You look at what Don Jr. said about getting him an AR-15. I think two people are dead now. He's caused enough damage with the AR-15, done in self-defense, according to the jury. So according to the law. And I could give one example after another, but there's just a growing list of quotes from members of Republican members of Congress calling for acts of violence or having campaign fundraisers where they're holding AR-15 or military style weapons and targeting other members of Congress. We, of course, know what the Arizona congressman did last week in anime targeting and killing in this cartoon a figure that was supposed to be AOC. This is mounting. There are consequences. We all ask Republican leadership to condemn this. They refuse. Kevin McCarthy has refused to condemn any of this. And it's happening inside his way. This is how fascism grows. This is how violence erupts. This is why people stand up at Trump events, Trump-affiliated events, saying, when do we get to start using our guns? Mm-hmm.
You know, Joe, we can stipulate to a couple of things, a bad law, a bad case, even some bad lawyering. We can stipulate to that. But we know that Kyle Rittenhouse has become a cause celebre because the trial bore the burden of a sense of panic in the country. There is a sense in which Kyle Rittenhouse defended himself against the marauding mob. And like him, we must defend ourselves because there are those who believe that white America is under siege. And so here we have this young man, 17-year-old, 18-year-old, who's now become the poster child for this sense of panic, this sense of grievance that the country is changing. And those folk who hold that view want to defend their vision of America with violence. We saw it on January 6th. We hear it in their voices. We hear it. We see it on television. And so part of what I think people wanted to hear from the president, at least I wanted to hear from the president, Joe, is not only the kind of words about we must respect the verdict of the jury, that much is true, but the jury's verdict enters into an environment where violence is on the horizon. The threat of a kind of civil war in the country is real, and people feel that their lives are in jeopardy. And I think I have a piece coming out in the Washington Post later on today about this. There's a kind of madness at the heart of the country, rooted in this insistence in what I'm calling a white innocence, Joe. We could talk about what I mean by that. And that innocence is actually embodied in Kyle Rittenhouse. And they are defending him as such because he represents their desires, their aims, their ambitions. It's very dangerous, Joe, and we have to recognize it as such.
Well, and he, I accept that totally, appreciate it. I agree with you. Here's my point. And it's and I think it's critical that Democrats especially take this on board, Eddie. My point is this. After the jury comes back, respect the jury, change the laws. Now, listen, if you want to go out and have marches and if you want 25 million people marching, awesome. But the Republican in me says, what are you doing there during those marches? Are you getting people's names? Are you getting their texts? Are you asking them while you're marching? Are you going to knock on doors in the campaign next year? Are you going to make phone calls next year? I understand. But here's the thing, and I don't want people to get angry at me. I'm right. just telling you what happened. Well, a lot of Democrats were marching in 2020. You know what Republicans were doing? They were knocking on doors. No, you don't like it because it's COVID. I understand that. But they were knocking on doors. They were making phone calls. They were doing the things that allowed them to shock Democrats in the Senate and in the House and in local races and in governor's races across the country. I guess what I'm saying is organize, organize, organize. But that organizing, it has to be about knocking on doors, making phone calls, planting signs in yards, because that's how you change the law. And that's how you make sure the next time something like this comes up, the jury gets other instructions that actually respect rule and order.
Joe, I hear you, Doc. I hear you. We've been talking about this for as long as I've been on the show. And let me just say this. Mm-hmm. We say all the time that two things could be true at once. So what you said right. is absolutely right. We need to change the law. But what have we been saying throughout this trial? That if it was a young black teenager with an AR-15 mm-hmm. at a MAGA rally, even with the laws on the books in Wisconsin, as they are, the law would not have applied equally at all. You know as well mm-hmm. as I know, if that was a black teenager, even with the self-defense laws on the books in Wisconsin, that young man would probably be dead or he would be going to prison right now. So there is this sense. And I just want, because we've been talking about this for a long time. Obviously, I'm awake now, right? We've been talking about this for a long time, that right. there feels to be these two senses of justice. And in this moment, when that is felt to appeal to changing the laws, doesn't map onto the reality of the felt and lived experience, if that makes sense. What do you think?
Well, I think that makes sense. Yeah. You're talking about what would have happened, what would have been likely to happen. And that's fine. I'm talking about what did happen. Now, let me just go one step back from where you were, because I've said it on this show. If it were a 17-year-old young black man with an AR-15 hanging around his neck, walking into a hot zone like that and going up to a police officer, this story would have ended there.
Yep.
And he would have been told to get back into his car and go back to where he came from, or else he'd be arrested for fill in the blank. That's what I think it's. Mm-hmm. People talked about this, and Charles, maybe you can comment on this too. You can jump in here. People commented about the fact that this kid illegally carrying a gun. He was 17 years old. He walks up to cops who are like, "Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, it's over." Yeah, and walks up to cops with it. I think Republicans can agree with this too. I mean, unless they just want to lie to themselves. If an underage black kid with an AR-15 was hanging around his neck and he walks up to police officers, I think that's the end of the story right there. They ask him for his ID. He's underage. He gets arrested.
You're absolutely right.
But this is speculation. I'm just saying, though, it seems obvious.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a point that I made on the show last week and when we were talking about this in the midst of the trial. But I do think that when you talk about the larger conversation, and I think that's also what Eddie and I are both getting at when you talk about where President Biden landed in this discussion, it's not simply good enough to leave it in the hands of the jury for something that has such greater implications. If we were in a space where we knew that there weren't going to be heightened periods of racial unrest in America, such that they would prompt the type of protest that has left Jacob Blake now a footnote in a story that started with him, then we might be able to live with a conversation about this simply being about that jury. But we know that that's not true. You know it and I know it. You know and I know that we are just one incident away from another series of protests. We are just one incident, one car stop away from another sort of explosion that happens all over the United States regarding racial reconciliation that we've been dealing with for decades now. And so because of that, because we know that we are likely to see these circumstances again, we can't just simply say, well, it's up to the jury and it's up to the law. We have to contextualize the conversation. And so from my perspective, and I believe that this is what Eddie was saying as well, it is somewhat irresponsible for the president to limit his remarks about Kenosha just to the jury and then say, well, you know, I agree with the jury and that's it. I understand why he came back and tried to clean it up on Twitter with respect to a larger statement and it being more political. But at the end of the day, it's very important that we have these conversations in proper context. And limiting this to just what happened with Kyle Rittenhouse, despite the fact that there was bad law, is despite the fact that the verdict was, that's not good enough.
Right. Yeah, I think the three of us could sit down and in about 3 minutes write a statement that we would want the president to say, because I think we're all kind of saying the same thing. And maybe that statement says what the president said. The first part, we respect the jury. At the same time, if you are angry, if you are upset, then I understand that. Let's change the law. Let's organize. Let's vote. Let's make it, et cetera, that sort of thing. But I agree. Eddie, final thoughts. I think we're all saying pretty much the same thing here as far as respecting the jury, but making a difference and changing things as we move forward.
Joe, I think we need to be very, very concerned about what the Tucker Carlsons, what the Matt Gaetz, what the Paul Gosar, what Gosar and all these folk are doing. Don't be surprised if, as Elie Mystel said in his Nation article, if Kyle Rittenhouse isn't speaking at the Republican convention. Don't be surprised if he's not put out there as a kind of example of white grievance defending itself, as a justification for arming yourselves to defend the America. He's going to be the darling of CPAC. You know this, Joe. So we're going to witness through him the intensification of our moment. And just wait. We got the Ahmaud Arbery decision coming. Hey, we're in the middle of a storm. You and I come from the coast. We know what hurricanes are like. We're not just simply in the eye, Joe. The tail is coming, man.
Well, on that happy note, Eddie, welcome back.
Thank you, Eddie. All right.
You woke up, baby. You woke up. Charles Colvin, thank you as well.
Thank you, Charles.
It's always great having you on. We appreciate it. And I'm sure we're going to be talking to you very soon about Arbery.